I am Doug Bloss. I'm Health Equity and Social Justice Coordinator for the Ingham County Health Department. That's where Lansing, Michigan, the capital is. And this is really fun for me, actually, to get to talk about the beginnings of my work at the health department, because my work now is very different, working on health equity and social justice. I found that the methods we used to address access to health care and community engagement back in 1998 were very different from what we're using now. I'm going to talk about the evolution of that a little bit. Just to give you an overview of where we're going to go in this brief presentation, I want to talk about the use of facilitated dialogue as a vehicle for change in our health department and our relationship with the community. I'll talk some about the methodology, which is based on technologies of participation, which is a method developed by the Institute for Cultural Affairs. I'm not going to teach that to you. I can't possibly, but I'm going to try to describe the basic idea of it, so you can investigate it if you'd like to. I'll talk about the application of that in the Community Voices project that we did throughout much of the last decade, using facilitated dialogue to elevate the community will. And finally, some limitations of that methodology as we try to apply it. We tried to apply it to the health equity and social justice issues and found it was lacking in some ways for that purpose. So basically, when I came to the health department in 98, and I had no background in public health, I was a facilitator. I was a consultant that helped plan and write grants and that sort of thing. The health department in Ingham County was very concerned with two questions. One was, how can we get community groups, organizations, and neighborhoods to see our resources as their assets? In other words, belonging to them, as opposed to this entity that just existed when you were referred to them every once in a while. And how could we get our organization to view the community's assets as our greatest resource? In other words, how do we get the community mobilized to do the work of public health, because it is the work, the public's work? So I'm going to sort of describe that. Community Voices, which was this 9-year project that we were involved with Kellogg, allowed us to give a lot of resources in the community. What it resulted in is a coverage plan that has continued ever since then, and at its highest point covered over 50% of the county's uninsured people within 6 years of starting it. The mobilization of the community around access to health care and elimination of disparities, community oversight of collaborative efforts, and finally the establishment of a number of neighborhood centers around our city and some in our rural areas as hubs for residents to pursue their own self-generated community health goals. I'm going to describe the top idea briefly. As I said, it's basically a sequence of inquiries. So you get, and this can apply either to a 2.5-3 hour session, planning session that you're doing, or a process that goes over 6 months or a year. The sequence of inquiry has been just incredibly helpful, I think, for doing planning processes that where you need a facilitator who is at least appears to be values-free, who stands in the middle of a room and has no opinion, and just gets the will of the people together. That's what I was doing back in 98 when we started this, and that's what this process is really good for. It goes from information to reflection to interpretation to decision. Actually, the top method, I think, uses adjectives. They say objective, reflective, interpretive, and decisional. This works better for me, so this is what we've been doing. And one way to think of this is that the informational pieces, one way to think of it is the senses, the stuff you can see and hear. Right? And that's why they say objective. Well, I don't think the senses are always objective. Basically, the idea of what you can see and hear. And then comes the feeling level. I make an effort not to use the word feelings in the course of these types of dialogues. I use questions like, what bothers you about, or what gratifies you about, so that we don't get into trouble with people getting all scared about feelings, because people get very scared about feelings. The meaning of those pieces of information, the senses and the feelings, and then finally, the action that we would take based on that. Asking questions, arranging activities in that series. I find this also works. Data has the informational piece. Experiences, the lived experiences of people as it relates to the data that's been presented is the next piece of it. Then insights that have developed from those two things, and finally strategies that we would use to make change happen. The best illustration of this, and it really does work, is to think of the alarm clock when it goes off in the morning. So the first thing that happens is you hear it and you see it. You have sensory stuff. You get a piece of information, the time. You have feelings about that. You have your past lived experience of waking up, and basically that's your feelings are partly based on that. You interpret what it means to hit the snooze button 2, 3, or 4 times. You reflect on past times when you have done that. You think of, you know, could I call in sick today? What would be the consequences of that? And then you take an action. You either get out of bed or you hit the snooze button or you call in sick. And that's about strategies. So the idea is that this is how brains naturally work. You do that in about 2 minutes' time, right, when you hear the alarm. So the idea is to take a group of people and walk them down a process in that way that leads them toward an action so that it makes sense. And you're not bouncing all over between these levels as we often do in community dialogues. So it's that's the idea. And also I want to point out that the decision level of this has to have a focus question that's clear from the very beginning of the process. This is what we're trying to answer. And it usually takes this form. What do we need to do to ensure access to care for the uninsured, eliminate educational gap for students of color in our community, any question you want to put in there, or what are some good ways to, that aims at strategies rather than actions. But you have this question figured out and you have it at the beginning of your process, whether it's half day or 6 months. So, how do we use this? That's not right. Basically, I'm going to just describe how we do it in a 3-hour process or so. First of all, there's a trigger for information. It can take many forms. It could be a reading that people have done beforehand. It can be a presentation of data. Usually, that's what happens. It can be a visioning exercise of some sort where you imagine, you know, the world a certain way, and then the information comes from what people saw and heard in that vision. Or it could be an experience that people have just had, something that's happened in our community, and you provide reflections on that. Then, what I use for the reflection piece is what I call open dialogue. Have these big boards that I spray with adhesive stuff, and so paper will stick to it. Doesn't have to be sticky post-it notes. Any paper will stick to it. And I put 3 anchor cards up that cover sort of areas of interest around that topic, and then I just let them say whatever they want to say. You know, the people that want to talk will talk the most during that, of course, but that's a natural process. And you try to get others to talk as well. And you record all the points on little index cards in threads so that after you're done, you can peel them off in threads and then reflect back what they have said to you in the report. And it's usually the most interesting part of the report because it gets out all the stuff, all the lived experience stuff that people have to share about the data. The interpretive phase then becomes a series of questions they're short answer questions, and they mirror the sequence that I said before: information, reflection, interpretation. Usually, the first question is, of everything you've seen and heard today, what stands out for you as surprising or important? And then you go through the bothering questions, the gratifying questions, the what does this mean questions, and you've summarized basically what the group has been saying for the past however much time, hour and a half or so. The final piece is a structured exercise to answer the focus question. Everybody takes 4 minutes to write down a list of really good answers, brainstorming answers to that question that we're trying to answer. They get into groups of 3 or 4 or 5 or whatever you've got and share their answers and come up with like 4 or 5 that they think as a group they can agree on. Those become then the basis for putting those cards. They write them on cards. You put them on the cards. You let them get into pairs of things that seem alike. Eventually, they have clusters. And so eventually, you have these 5 to 12 clusters of cards on a board, which you then label. And those become the basis, the fundamental structure for an action plan. Findings, recommendations, you can call them whatever you want, but it's a basic idea of what all this whole group together has come together to decide they want to do. Now I want to talk about the application of that in a longer period process. These 2 initial things we did with Community Voices, the Access to Health Dialogues and the Community Health Summits that we had. Because as I said, you can use that sequence for a short session to get information from a group, what they want to do, or you can apply it over a long term to come up with a more detailed sort of process. So the goal of the Access to Health Dialogues was to establish an organized system of care for the uninsured. The goal of the Community Health Summits, which were happening at the same time, was to mobilize neighborhoods and communities to improve access and positively impact social determinants of health. So, I'm going to talk about the Access to Health Dialogues here. I have some other slides about the Community Health Summits coming up. Basically, for Access to Health, we interviewed 4 groups of people: providers, insurers, consumers, and purchasers of healthcare. And a 5th group emerged called the linkers, people that were linking people to care. And we sort of compiled all that into a very elaborate report that every single point that was made in that interview, those interviews could be expressed as the story as told by those 5 groups. We had a huge community town hall meeting where we shared that with about 150 people. We then held, based on that meeting, held learning sessions to go deeper into the information, and at the end of about 8 months had another town hall meeting to share where we were at that point and get validation for what we were hearing about what we needed to do for access to care. And doing this process, before this process started, everyone was saying, yes, healthcare is a right, and I can't do it, somebody else ought to. That was the common response. At the end of the process, we had everybody sort of on board behind a series of statements about what we should be doing as a community. We had a plan for creating this thing called the Ingham Health Plan to cover uninsured people. And we assigned the role of oversight to a access to health committee of a coalition of healthcare interests that we had in our community called the Capillary Health Alliance. On the other side, I'm going to not describe the Community Health Summit side right now because I'm going to go through that in more detail in just a second. But I want to say more about the action plan. This action plan that we created in, I think, 2001 had these goals. And we reported then every 3 years after that, we reported back to the community the progress made on those goals. And by about 2007, we decided to reiterate the process again. So we did another series of dialogues on a number of issues and created a whole new plan that was much more sophisticated than the original one, because we had seen our success in covering all these people, and we had seen what other issues were emerging in covering people in this way. And so we had a whole new sort of round of dialogues around that. Now, in the Community Health Summit process, simultaneously to this, we were going to neighborhoods in Lansing, and you see three of them here. We actually had seven different summits. And we gave them money from the grant to basically hire someone to do what they called leadership institutes. And that could be someone from their neighborhood, it could be a bunch of people from their neighborhood, it could be someone they liked from Michigan State University or somewhere else, to come basically interview people to get information from the neighborhood about what they thought needed to happen. What was health? What did health mean in their terminology? And what would have to be done to do something about that? We held summit events in each one of these neighborhoods or communities. There, two of them were dedicated to the issues of African Americans in our community and one to Latinos. And then we came together with that information to hold this summit event. It was a half-day event, usually 150 people, everyone. I don't know what the magic number 150 is, but that's what seems to come to community health summit events that we've had. I think Malcolm Gladwell says something about that in the tipping point, too, 150. I don't know. It's mysterious. I'm not a scientist, so I don't go there. So we held these summit events, and we used the top process to get a number of, you know, clusters of answers to what was community health and what do we do about it. That created action plans for each one of these neighborhoods who then, let me just tell you though, when we went into neighborhoods to ask this question, the kind of things they came up with for health were not the kind that we would have normally thought about. Economic development, housing, leadership, sense of well-being, safety. All of them, though, all of them had as a fundamental piece that social connection was critical to health. And that's what sort of led to each one of these groups then developing plans for programming and action teams and actually going out and getting partners to help them. And we didn't have to supply a lot of money. We became a major partner for them, but a lot of other institutions around town did as well, to come up with activities that would respond to these needs they had identified. These places are still going on and still going really strong. They continually amaze. They're pushing us now. You know, they're pushing us. Are you doing something about this? Shouldn't you be doing something about this? Where's the support you said you were going to give us? You know, and that's not just us, but all the other sort of institutions in town. And they're coming up with all kinds of. These are just some pictures from the Allen Neighborhood Center. Love this one. One of their answers to why this fence kept getting knocked down by cars backing into it in their neighborhood was to make a nice mural, of course. So, I mean, and now nobody backs into it anymore. That's the kind of thing that they do. I'll hurry up here. They're very big on basically getting people from the neighborhood to help become ambassadors for housing, to first-time homebuyers to sell houses, to tell them all the benefits of living in this side of town, you know, other than what they might have heard from other folks. They got a grant to do a greenhouse. They have a greenhouse. They have a raised beds for people with disabilities in their hoop house there. It's just amazing stuff they keep doing. These are our healthcare navigators up in that top picture And I mentioned that because the reason we got to 50% covering uninsured is because these people were going door to door in the neighborhood saying, do you have health insurance? It was their entree. You know, asking that question was their entree to get into getting them connected to a whole host of other types of things. And they would go, and they have to do it like three times maybe to get there, to actually get the connection going, but they do, and they're amazing at it. More recently, we continued to use this process for a whole host of issues. In fact, for a while there, all I was doing was social determinants of health stuff, doing dialogues for other things like education, employment, adult daycare, all kinds of things, using the process because we weren't ready to do social justice yet in 2007 when we said we were. I'll tell you more about that in a second. Which is one example, the Walk and Bike Lansing Initiative. And this was done by a community member. I taught the process to a community member who she went and interviewed like 150 organizations on walking and biking and what was needed. They held four community forums to try to come together on ideas of what should happen. Resulted in a complete streets ballot initiative that they developed. The idea was that any new streets or any repaired streets had to have access for biking and walking in it and for access for those with disabilities. Okay. And they didn't actually have to do the ballot initiative because they became so powerful that the mayor and the council approved it without going to the ballot. Social justice project. Limitations of the mansion. We did an internal dialogue process using the top method saying, what do we need to do to adopt a health equity social justice framework for our practice in public health? We had we developed a plan, we shared it with senior staff, and said all the things we needed to do to change our practice. Everybody applauded, and nothing, absolutely nothing happened. So what are the limitations? We discovered that this process is less effective when it's used to effect a broad institutional change for which the sufficient buy-in has not yet been developed. We didn't really have the buy-in yet to go toward a new framework for public health. It's very helpful in determining what a group of people believe and want. It's not so helpful in making them believe or want it. It's not good when you're trying to create a cosmetic shift that requires no real action by stakeholders. In the beginning, the Social Justice Project did not have an actual mandate to bring about change. At best, it was intended to describe a theoretical change. That's all we were doing in 2005, 6, and 7 when we started the Social Justice Project. And it can't be applied you can't apply a values-free orientation to social justice. You just can't. It doesn't work. Social justice facilitators can't be neutral because the neutrality is the stance that so often serves to maintain the status quo. We actually, if we use the thought process to try to identify and eliminate racism, I mean, the racial privilege would assert itself immediately. And everybody would walk away because nothing was going to happen. So we have a whole different approach. That's a whole different story. We could talk about that some other time. Thank you.